a lot of people I find, when you ask about their purpose, they'll say to make a difference. Now, that's actually a really good test of what a purpose is, but it isn't, in fact, a purpose itself. Because human beings generally want to make some kind of difference. The gold and the real sense of purpose comes from what kind of difference is it that you want to make.
Welcome to Upon Arrival, a show that uncovers stories and strategies that make up all the moving parts of business events tourism with me, Adelaine Ng. If you're feeling like you're on the edge of burning out, join the club. Many of us are not sure how we got to this point when in a lot of cases, we've actually gotten what we wished for. More work from home hours, more flexibility from our bosses, more time with our family. What we didn't bargain for was what feels like burnout. Surprise, right? So how did we get here and what do we do about it? My guest in this episode has just written a book on exactly this topic, specifically for the emerging post-pandemic world we find ourselves living in. Dr. Karen Morley is a leadership psychologist and leadership coach who has a new book called Flexibility. And here's a twist. Listening back to the contents of this interview before sharing it with you has taken a new personal meaning for me. One of the things my healthcare practitioners have diagnosed me with is low cortisol. And they think it stems from an experience I had at work years ago, which was highly stressful at the time. What I didn't know was that I never recovered from that stress. I thought I did, but guess what? Not dealing with it properly is impacting my health today. Wow. So trust me and Karen when we say everything's interconnected. How you manage your day, your emotions, the clarity of knowing your purpose and your ability to be flexible impacts your well-being for years to come. Here's that interview. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to join you.
It's a great book that you've written. It showed a great understanding of the pain a lot of people are going through with work from home and the impact that it's having on our mental health. But our listeners, of course, may not have read your book. So let's start with the stories you've been hearing from the people you've been working with. We all know that there's issues with having the lines blurred between what's office, what's home and school. What have people been telling you about their experiences navigating all these shifting boundaries?
Well, where do I start? There are so many different stories, although I've got to say there's a lot of commonality in the experiences that people are having and the experiences over the last 2 years. And I think one of the things that's most critical to remind ourselves of is that it has been 2 years. That's a really long time to be dealing with very unusual different circumstances, to be asked to do more, to do differently, to pivot, you know, pivot again, and let's pivot one more time. I mean, that's a huge ask. With the business leaders that I coach, even before the pandemic, it was very clear that a lot of people were just teetering on the edge of burnout. So people were working very hard. They had very high expectations. I work with high achievers and they place a lot of demands on themselves. So before the point of COVID, lots of demand, etc. There was some burnout, but I guess we thought at that time it was, you know, an expected amount of burnout in the community of leaders and the community of workers. But so many things happened. So number one was the big uncertainty. The fact of people working from home. Now, originally, or when we were in the early stages of COVID, okay, very uncertain, people were changing their priorities, but they were doing whatever it took. So they were working longer hours, they were doing it differently, they were, you know, problem solving new problems and challenges. And that lasted for about 3 or 4 months, but it hasn't let up since then. And that, I think, is the biggest concern right now. People have been surging. They've been in crisis mode for 2 years. And we kind of think that at some point in the future, we'll get to this wonderful, you know, paradise where things will go back to normal, where we won't have these kinds of challenges. We'll get back to things the way they were, and that's not going to happen. And so people are struggling with what that means in terms of where they work. But also I think people are struggling a lot with themselves around how they should respond. I think one of the really big challenges that's come out of the last couple of years is that there's an increased fear that people have about the security of their work. And I think that's one of the drivers that's keeping people working the long hours, keeping the high expectations, even though, as you say, there are so many other expectations with family and community that have added to the mix of that.
Wow. I mean, when you describe things that way, it sounds like a really toxic cocktail that's about to explode. And all of that must have some kind of long-term impact on our nervous system. I mean, you're nodding your head.
Yes, and people can't see that, but that is absolutely the case. And I think talking about it as a toxic cocktail is a good way to describe it, because we can't surge and continue to surge, and our bodies aren't designed for that. You know, our bodies are designed to respond to, you know, crises with, that fight or flight response. But we're not meant to stay in that mode. And I think a lot of people have, and that's what's contributing to the feeling of burnout. I think, you know, in a technical sense, not everybody is necessarily feeling burnt out, which is about feeling exhausted, feeling somewhat cynical about your work and feeling that you're not effective. But I do think that many people are feeling exhausted, and that's more than enough to be concerned. When our bodies are in fight or flight mode for too long, the wrong kinds of hormones are circulating throughout our bodies, and they do have toxic effects. So we can talk about a toxic cocktail in the broader world around us, if you like, and that's what's provoking and promoting these sorts of behaviours. But internally, there's also a toxic cocktail of cortisol in particular, which stays in the bloodstream for too long. It leads to inflammation. There's very clear findings from the World Health Organization around the impact of chronic stress and overwork and burnout at work, and that is you are more likely to die. It impacts on your brain and your brain's ability to function. It potentially increases the chances of dementia. It has all sorts of outcomes that we should be very, very concerned about.
I mean, I have a former colleague whose mother passed away, and she says that she died from overwork. And that was the first time I thought, wow, there's such a thing. And I think a lot of times we don't realize how much burnout affects us until we find ourselves in hospital, or we hear stories of people who end up in hospital. Mm. And it's just one of those things where you get onto this treadmill and you just don't know when to stop, and you think you're okay until your body tells you no way, you can't push anymore. So yeah. Let's try to be, I guess, better at recognizing the signs that we need to start taking notice of, which we can talk about a little bit later on. But there are some stats in your book that quite shocked me. I mean, you bring up this global study by Asana claiming that during the pandemic, only 26% of time was spent on meaningful work, and a whopping 60% is spent on working on work, quote unquote. Can you explain that a little bit more? Because we think that we're doing all of this to be more productive, but the reverse is true.
Yes, yes. I think a lot of our time is actually being wasted, so that makes it doubly unnecessarily and doubly concerning. The work about work thing is when we're arranging work or we're changing our work practices. Now, we did have to do a bit of that when the pandemic started and organisations had people working from home. There were some things we needed to do to change, just how did we exchange documents if that wasn't already set up? How did we arrange our meetings? How did we connect with our customers? So setting up those systems is work about work. So it doesn't actually produce anything new that's tangible. What it does is help us change the way we were already doing something. So work about work is where we're changing what we do. We're introducing, new systems. We're changing those practices. It doesn't create at least in the short term, it doesn't create any different kind of outcome or any different amount of work. Now, obviously, a lot of the systems changes that we've looked to make over, I don't know, the last 20, 25 years have been about increasing productivity. And certainly the systems do allow that, but I'm just gobsmacked. That's a technical word, I think, but I'm really gobsmacked by the number of people who say to me, their diaries are full from beginning of the day to the end of the day. That's probably a 12-hour stretch for people who are working in global organizations. That might be even longer. Those meetings, a number of them are pointless. They don't necessarily have agendas. It's not clear why people are there. There are a lot of people who don't say anything in the meeting. There aren't necessarily clear outcomes. And then what you do is you find yourself in Groundhog Day the next week or the next month, having that same meeting with the same people in the room. And what's the difference? What's the value that came from the last meeting? It's really questionable. So I think that there's a lot of unproductive time that people are spending at work. And quite a bit of my coaching over the last couple of months has turned to actually getting people to get their diaries out in front of them. And let's look at what's happening on a day-to-day basis. Let's look at what you're doing and why you're doing it, and make the assessment of what's valuable for you or not. And then thinking about what can you do to help manage your day and your week and your month in a different way so that you can feel like you want to come to work, you can feel like the demands aren't too great, and you know, you're experiencing success or achievement in the work that you do. And when you do that and when you're focused on that, then that's going to be dealing with a lot of the potential criteria that create burnout.
I think some of the things in our schedule we kind of already know would be things that we could easily remove. We just maybe need the permission to be able to talk to our bosses or to the other people who are party to that meeting about your real needs. But then I think a lot of us also don't really know where to start with this. I mean, I don't even consider myself a super high achiever, and yet I look at my schedule and I have times blocked from morning till evening for different parts of my life. I mean, from writing work to looking after my clients to running my podcast to seeing healthcare practitioners, Zoom calls, business building, volunteer responsibilities. I don't even have time for important things like exercise and journaling and a few other things labeled important but not urgent that I know need to be in there. So I suspect you say that maybe that's not burnout. It's probably overwhelm. But in any case, I'm thinking, I don't know how this happened, but what do I need to change if I can't take anything out?
Yeah, I think that's overwork, which is not the same as burnout. I think when you're in a state of burnout, it can be hard to kind of get out of bed in the morning to feel motivated to do the work. So, you know, it's a real shift that you notice in your whole perspective and demeanor and ability to do work. And I think a lot of people might be like you. You sort of teeter on the edge of doing way too much, but you don't flip into burnout, luckily. You don't. So that's good. So why don't we do that? I think there are things like fear of missing out, particularly for achievers or moderate achievers. There's the fear of authority figures. I know I was having a conversation with someone recently who was getting up at 4 a.m. in the morning in order to be able to spend a couple of hours doing her writing and policy work that she needed to do, which was, you know, the crux of her job. She was doing that before her workday started. So that's just crazy. She's got young children, amongst other things, and she's just a human being. Doing that is a slippery slope to burnout or exhaustion, or giving up, which is the thing that a number of women in particular have done during COVID in the face of all of those sorts of challenges. It becomes too hard, so you give up as a consequence. So I think what you can do, what I write about in the book, is that to get back kind of in charge of your work and your work environment, you need to get back in charge of yourself. So the book starts with a focus on first understanding what's happening when you are under stress and pressure. It's important to know that, so at least you're aware of what it is you're doing. And if you choose to keep working, if you choose to experience those levels of stress, at least you have some understanding of what's going on. And it might shift you know, how wedded you are to doing things in that way. But the most important thing to do is to have a sense of purpose, particularly if people want to have a balanced life. And just about everyone I know does want to have some sense of balance. So that, yes, work is important, but also exercising and taking care of yourself is, and being involved and engaged with your family is as well. So really being able to outline what your purpose is, to be able to say it, makes a huge difference. It has a very big impact on well-being. So it's a buffer against stress, simply having a purpose. Even if you don't change your work practices or how much time you spend working, it's going to be a buffer for your health. But I think the reason that I advocate having a purpose and a clear purpose so strongly is that what it does is change the choices you make. So if you're thinking about the kind of life you want to live and how you're going to live out your purpose, then it might shift the importance you place on exercise. So the fundamentals of exercise, good nutrition and sleep, they just need to be there. And I know when the going gets tough and there's too much pressure, what are the things that go first? They do. Mm-hmm. But really focusing on those means that you can, I guess you can work more productively yourself. So having that sense of purpose. And the other thing that is in that first part of the book is also this idea of psychological flexibility and being freer with your thinking, freer with your feelings and how you respond to the things around you, and being a bit more curious and creative about what you do. And I think we often end up feeling stuck, like I can't say no to this meeting, or my sense of authority or my sense of my future career is based on, you know, being involved in this particular project or doing it in this particular way. So often we've got thoughts that we tell ourselves about our self-worth, our capability, how important things are, that we could really question. And so that chapter in the book really talks about how to do that, some different ways to ask yourself some different questions, to ask some different perspectives on what's happening, to think about how to be less emotionally attached to some things. You know, sometimes we really feel like we're emotionally stuck, or we feel like we have to respond in particular ways. And while that doesn't necessarily take more time, it actually erodes our energy.
Yeah. It's the little things, isn't it? But that sense of purpose that you talk about, I mean, I know that you've got, you know, some great exercises in your book to be able to take us through that. But purpose is a really big word, and it sounds like such a vague thing for some people, even after listening to someone like Simon Sinek. So for those having a little trouble here, looking at the exercises and going, I still don't know what to fill in that blank. Are there key questions we can ask ourselves to, I guess, get a little bit more hyper-focused on producing the answer that is authentic to ourselves?
Yeah. I've got a sentence structure that you can use, because I think it is so interesting, isn't it, that purpose seems to be so important. And I think most people could say that, or if, you know, you ask them whether it was important, they'd agree. But then so many people say, oh, I struggle with that, it's all too hard. And it's a very kind of smart, switched on people who struggle with it. And sometimes ending up with just a sense of your purpose without necessarily having a very nicely wordsmith sentence is fine. But I think using that sentence structure is really useful. I also think that asking other people what their purpose is really important too. So you get people talking about what's important to them, then it's, you know, really you can say, well, no, that doesn't fit for me, so that's probably not my purpose. But think, oh, wow, I love the sound of what you just said. What's in that for me and my purpose? I think there's a really strong connection to values. So often, you know, the values are kind of the what. Whereas purpose is a bit of the why, you know, why am I here? And values can help to get clearer about what your purpose is. So I think there are a few ways of doing it. A lot of people I find, when you ask about their purpose, they'll say to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's actually a really good test of what a purpose is, but it isn't, in fact, a purpose itself, because human beings generally want to make some kind of difference. The gold and the real sense of purpose comes from what kind of difference is it that you want to make. So the difference that I make is about helping people to achieve their full potential. I haven't always been able to say that, that's for sure. But if I look back at my career and look at, or even when I was much younger, the various things that I did, what I got enjoyment and satisfaction from, and what seems to be a driving force, it's a version of that, helping other people to fulfill their potential.
That is such a key difference that you've just pointed out. And I love that idea of how if you're feeling completely lost about trying to define your purpose, you know, try and see what sparks inside of you when you look at other people's defined purposes, and that's a clue. And when you start putting all those clues together, as you pick up different things that inspire you, you get a little bit closer as time goes on in terms of sifting what exactly is closer to your authentic self. So I actually love that you've made it so easy. You did mention psychological flexibility, and I think the word that we've been using is resilience, and we now almost roll our eyes at that word. But what's a typical work situation when high achievers can still hit a wall when it comes to this? I think you had a case study called Marlena in your book.
Yes, there are a few different elements of all of that. And I think that high achievers driven by purpose can often push themselves incredibly hard, but then they do get to a point where, you know, the plates are spinning in the air and it all seems about to become a bit catastrophic. So one of the issues is around resilience and thinking that we can just keep pushing ourselves harder. Now, high achievers are often quite resilient. And I think we actually need to look at human nature itself as being quite resilient. You look at what we've done over the last couple of years and how we've survived all of that sort of confusion and the issues and the challenges that have been faced. We don't have an issue with resilience. We have an issue with recharging. We have an issue with how we manage our energy and our expectations. And that's where psychological flexibility comes in. Instead of thinking to prove I'm resilient, I just have to keep toughing this out. If I'm resilient, I can take this. I can take kind of everything. I can keep kind of taking on responsibility. And I'll be able to do it. I think we tend to see resilience as almost this endless capacity. And if you can't do something, if you can't achieve something, then people tend to see themselves as being not resilient. Whereas resilience isn't really like that at all. I mean, it's something that is more about kind of flexibility itself. But in terms of managing energy and thinking differently about the energy side of what we're talking about, the idea of recharging and recharging often is a much better tactic. So I'm not quite answering your question. I'm kind of going back to the earlier part of our conversation in a sense. And really this idea about kind of stress and resilience is important. So we get stressed, our body goes into fight or flight. Now, if it stays there too long, as we've already said, that becomes a toxic cocktail. But in effect, when we're thinking about resilience as something we can keep pushing through and we should be able to handle this, then what we do is encourage ourselves to stay in fight or flight mode, to not question that. But of course, because of the toxic effects, we need to. And so recharging means that we flip out of fight or flight into rest and digest. And really the best way of, if you like, reframing, rethinking about resilience is to think about it as the need to recharge very regularly through your day. So you have a stressful day, but in that day, instead of thinking, I'll just get through this stress until the end of the day and then I'll collapse on the sofa and, you know, binge Netflix, whatever it might be, Every hour, I'm going to take 5 minutes of that hour just for a quick walk around the office or the house or the whatever it is. I'm going to do something that allows me to recharge my energy, to get out of fight or flight, and just to feel nice, to feel good, to feel that sense of kind of warmth and care from others, or a sense of peace and relaxation. And even little moments, 5 minutes or so, of that kind of recharging can have a really big difference on how we feel at the end of the day.
And this is so applicable, I mean, in a situation that you raise in your book where somebody may choose not to take on additional responsibility or take on a new role, even though it means a promotion, because of this psychological flexibility question. And then once you learn this, there's so much more scope you can kind of work with, and you know what you can say yes and no to, which I think was so key. But I think one of my personal biggest takeaways from your book was that idea that you just talked about regarding recharging, because I think with most of the population, we think of recharging as this time on the weekend where we can recover from, you know, what happened from Monday to Friday, or sometimes overspilling into Saturday and sometimes even Sunday. But that idea of disconnecting fully when you're not working, or disconnecting fully, even those breaks, those periodic breaks that you need to give yourself while you're working. It's really interesting because I find that I might be at a Zumba class, for example, trying to follow the instructor, but my brains are really somewhere else at work. I find that really hard to disconnect.
Yeah. So that's the idea of detachment. So the two things are really important for getting to rest and digest and really recover your energy. One's the brief moments of recharging in a very kind of very frequent sort of sense. And the other is detaching and getting that full detachment from work. And I think that's one of the things that's been hardest with working from home. It's been hard to divorce yourself, to really detach from work. If you've previously worked in the office and now all of your paraphernalia is at home, it's reminding you all the time about work. And so that detachment has become, I think, even more important. And things like having a pretend commute, if you've worked from home all day, shut down the laptop. Go for a walk around the block with the headphones in, 5, 10, 15 minutes to have a pretend commute. And during that time, you're telling yourself, I'm finishing up work and now I'm moving from work mode to home mode. That kind of detachment is just critical. I find quite often, because I've worked from home for 10 years, running my own practice, and I quite like the interplay, actually, but I need to be quite disciplined about working and not working. But one of the things that's most enjoyable for me in terms of detachment is traveling. And when you're traveling, you know, the minute you're out the door, you're on the plane or in the car, got the suitcase, got the camera, for me, it's like work disappears completely. And I am in a very different zone. And not having had holidays for the last couple of years for many people is a bit of an issue for that as well. If people use that like I do as the way to detach, then that's a bit of an issue. But hopefully people are able to get back to that this year.
What did you do then? Because you've had your circumstance, I mean, you had everything planned and laid out in terms of how you will recharge and how your operating system will thrive in a work from home situation. But when you can't do the very thing that you've relied on to recharge, how did you work those things out for yourself?
One of the things that I did quite early after COVID hit was to actually have a bit of a strategic planning session with myself about my business and my practice. And because of the uncertainties, what was really good, it was about going back to purpose and my life purpose. It was getting back to values. And what I decided to do, because I didn't know what was going to happen to my business at all, it became very, very uncertain. What I decided to do was that I was going to let it go. And what would happen would happen. I mean, I'm at a later point in my career, so it's less, I guess, important for me to be growing a business and thinking about a 20, 30, 40 year career. But what I found really useful was just to let it go and to feel like I could drift a bit and I would see what eventuated, but that I wasn't going to try and push at a time when people didn't want development because they were too busy deciding how they were going to work and if they were even going to survive. I just figured it wasn't going to make any sense. And so that was permission giving for me. And what was really nice about that is that I prioritized exercise and sleep, which hadn't been such priorities for a while. And I've got to say that since then, for the last 2 years, I'm so proud of this. Sorry, I'm a bit bragging now. But for the last 2 years, I've exercised every single day.
Wow.
And it's now at the point where I can't not do it. And so, you know, that flip, sometimes the best way, the easiest way to make big decisions like that, to change big habits like that, is to have a big disruption. Now, we're not going to wish the COVID disruption on anyone, but if you're finding that you can't, say, exercise right now, that that's something that you really struggle to put in, what you need to do is engineer a bit of a disruption for yourself that changes that. That allows you to kind of rethink about purpose, focus, what you want to do, how important that is. And then in chapter 6 of the book, I actually talk a lot about habits because this is exactly what happens for all of us. You know, we kind of get hooked into habits around meetings, around not exercising, and shifting them when we're very busy and have too many things to do is really hard. It is just very hard. And so, you know, having some kind of disruption or a reframe around purpose and focus, having, you know, one or two people around you who want to do the same thing so that you can work together and get some social support is really, you know, what's required to create that disruption.
Yeah, so you've got a couple of people now hooked on trying to find out, okay, I can actually disrupt things myself. Like, are you talking about just trying to find a buddy online and saying something like, oh, you know, at, I don't know, 9 a.m. on Thursdays, we're going to do something together and be accountable to each other? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I would make it somebody you know. So somebody you know that maybe you've had little conversations, what are you doing about this? And I don't, and we're both stuck, for example. You might be stuck in different things, but you have a sense that you want to create some kind of change. Take yourself somewhere different that you don't normally go. So you're creating a different kind of space. Engage with each other in different ways. If you normally sit down and have coffee, maybe stand up and walk and talk. To have the conversation and do a bit of a strategic planning session. Ask each other questions about your purpose and your focus and what you want to do. And there's lots of activities, as you say, in the book that you can use the questions and some of the information to help each other with. And then at the end of that, you've got to come down to some really clear, specific goals, actions for things you want to do differently. And there's some simple ways to keep yourselves honest around that in the book, a little daily reflection piece, which I advocate all the time, which is quite easy to do, but it's really about making sure that you're doing something every day to focus on, you know, whatever you want to change and you're seeing the benefit of it.
And I think, I may be wrong, but I think you mentioned self-sabotage in your book. How does that play out when we're trying to create new habits for ourselves and trying to break out of this burnout, constant exhaustion, constant overwhelm? What do we need to recognize in ourselves when there is self-sabotage at play, and then how do we work ourselves out of that?
Yeah, I think that I don't talk too much about self-sabotage because, you know, when people are busy and they're feeling really stressed, the last thing you need is to feel really bad about yourself, but often people do. So you beat yourself up for not being, like, extraordinarily, amazingly wonderful. So I think the ways that we self-sabotage are often quite unconscious, and it's really the things that we're doing that we hold to be valuable, like putting our effort into work. Like having high standards, like not wanting to let the team down. What we don't do, I guess, is think about ourselves and our energy and our focus and our attention as being critical to achieving that and to being the best contributor to that. And I think the other thing we do is we stay on the treadmill when actually the controls for the treadmill are in front of us. So we can change the speed. We can stop. And so I think it's that, you know, there's a dilemma and we've got so many competing commitments and competing goals and we live, you know, complex lives and that's all reasonable. I think at the end of the day, there are many more choices we have. There are many more things that we can decide for ourselves. And so the kind of the sabotage comes from either not being clear and saying, well, actually, I'm just going to work my guts out. I'm going to take the consequences because I want something. Or saying, actually, I need to give up how much I want that something. It's not really the important thing, but I'm kind of hooked on that. And what I need to do is rearrange how I spend my time. So that each day, each week, each month, I'm actually enjoying myself. I'm enjoying my work. I get to spend time with my family. They know who I am. They're not complaining about never seeing me, so that we can actually get that back into balance.
Yeah. Karen, can I ask what got you interested in this topic in the first place? Is there a personal story?
I think there are probably a few different strands. And one is that when I began my career as a psychologist, I was working in a small health centre dealing with women and children who were mostly victims of violence in some way, shape or form. And after about a year, I burnt out. I didn't realise what that was, but thankfully I had a GP who at the time did and who talked about what that was and suggested a break. And so that's been something, thinking about our energy and how we use our energy at work is something that's really important for me, that comes up from time to time. So that was one of the threads. Another was, though, being really concerned around particularly gender equality, but also inclusion and diversity and equality more generally. When the pandemic hit, I got so excited because I thought, here comes flexible work. We are finally going to break through this barrier that's been there that's really stopped flexible work from becoming mainstream. And so I was very excited for a while, and then I was crestfallen when I started to see, yes, we could get back to work, but there were CEOs who were saying, everybody's back in the office or else. And I thought, hang on, haven't we just seen the light? Haven't we just seen how possible this is? And I think what underpins all of that is just a lack of trust in people, a lack of trust in people who do the work in your organisation and how toxic that actually is. And that's part of the toxic cocktail, I think, that you referred to at the beginning of the conversation, these expectations that we have of what people should do that make no sense. So I've got a commitment to making work better, making workplaces nicer places to be, as well as helping people think about their own expectations, the ones that they place on themselves.
Well, it's clear what your purpose is, and it's a very great purpose.
Well, thank you.
We have been talking about burnout throughout, but I mentioned at the start about ways we can recognize when we are getting to that point where it's harmful. How do we know that we really need to look at it seriously? We need to do something about it, because it's very easy to just brush it off and just get on with our lives and do the very next thing that's right before us, another box to tick. So, you know, what kind of warning signs should we be looking out for?
Yeah. And I think we can look for warning signs in ourselves, but I think one of the really important things that we can do is look for warning signs in other people, because it's often when somebody asks us about how we're feeling and how stressed we are and how burned out we are, that we really start to pay attention to it in a different way. So I think that that's really important to do. But I think the three things that make up burnout are exhaustion. So constantly feeling tired, not being able to sleep, lying awake at night and ruminating about your to-do list or the sorts of things, the work that's coming up. So you're kind of working rather than sleeping even during the night. That's one thing that's important. So how tired you are, fatigued and exhausted. This other thing is about feeling cynical about your work. So, you know, some people do feel cynical anyway, so we're not talking about people who generally do feel cynical. Yes. But if you're someone who's been a good performer and you like your work, you enjoy your work, but you start to feel cynical about it, or you start to feel like it doesn't matter so much and question its purpose, then that's another sign. And the final sign is around feeling effective. I mean, I know in that first time that I felt burnout that I mentioned earlier, I felt like I was, you know, meeting with these women and children and that it wasn't making a difference. And so all three of these things really compound on each other. The other thing that seems to make a big difference about actually tipping over from being kind of just exhausted and stressed into feeling burnt out is around how fair you feel things are. So if you think that you're working super hard, you're tired, all of those things, and the workplace isn't fair, like some people are working hard and other people aren't working hard, or your organisation maybe doesn't have integrity, or it keeps pushing people to work really hard but doesn't acknowledge how hard they are and doesn't seem to allow them to let up, then that will have a big impact on flipping people into burnout as well. So thinking in terms of the signs about the tiredness, etc., also thinking about the fairness in the environment, totaling up the number of hours you work, how much time do you spend in your day working versus not working, thinking about whether or not you feel exhausted, do you feel tired all the time? So some of those questions, I think, are useful ones to ask. And like I said, sometimes it's when other people ask you these questions, how many hours are you working? When was the last time you, you know, just enjoyed a casual walk and a stroll and a coffee? And that can help people to reflect on how they're feeling.
Yeah, and the answer for me would be too long ago. So I definitely
need to... Not good, Elaine.
I need to really get into your book and read it from top to bottom, because it is fantastic. Now, I know it is such a resource, your book, but are there any other resources? Like, are there more resources on your website, or where do you usually point people to when they really need work in this area?
So there are a few things. Firstly, I post on LinkedIn very frequently, so often on this topic or related topics and leadership. On my website, there are several pages devoted to flexibility. And one of the resources that's there is called a flexibility challenge. So what I've actually done is to split up a lot of the information and the to-do sections into 26 fortnightly emails. So if you sign up to the Flexibility Challenge, what will happen is that you'll receive an email every fortnight which will have a bit of a suggestion about focusing on, you know, being flexible, thinking about burnout, thinking about how you're working, your work habits, etc. And there'll be a couple of resources as well as a worksheet. So you can work your way through the worksheet to ask yourself questions, give yourself a pat on the back if you get the right answers. Otherwise, it's an opportunity to identify, okay, there's something that I can do to increase my well-being.
Fantastic. I think we'll put all the links to those resources in the show notes, as well as a link to your book. Very easy to read, but at the same time, a deep book that takes you through deep work if you do the work. So it is called Flexibility: How High Achievers Beat Burnout and Find Freedom in an Overworked World. Karen, what's the best way for people to connect with you if they wish to?
Probably through LinkedIn. Certainly, if people mention the show, I'd be really happy to connect with them. Otherwise, see them there.
Fantastic. Karen, I've learned so much, and your book is not thick, but there is so much in it, and I think it's life-changing. So thank you so much for doing it.
Oh, thank you so much. It's wonderful to hear you say that, and I appreciate the conversation. It's been terrific.
And hey, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the chat, I would love a rating and review for this show on the podcast player you're using. And by the way, if you ever wanted to start a podcast, I have links in the show notes to some of my favorite tools, including a 15% discount for riverside.fm. And if you need a hand to find out how to use them, reach out and say hello at uponarrivalpodcast@gmail.com. I'll be back next week to uncover more stories and strategies for a successful future. Till then, cheers.